Gayusita means let us move forward, and I want to teach you how to pronounce it. Gayusita. 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 Let us move forward. Madan Alakirelovunga, your Inuk host on Words and Culture to talk about our Inuit language, Inuktitut. Please join me as we move forward, Gayusiluta, to another great interview in the next episode, because our people are doing amazing things for our languages. Atsunai!
Words and Culture is made possible with funding from SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Words and Culture is produced by Kim Wheeler. Kaylin Belair is our audio engineer and editor.
Onigiwahi.
Gigawabamin. Soko seni denit e ninen yuji hina.
Eko se.
Kakuhutau. We'll see you again.
Hello and welcome to Viewpoints. On this week's show, we'll have two very interesting stories for you out of Ontario and New Brunswick. A professor at the University of Western Ontario is looking at whether the National Day for Truth and Reconciliation on September 30th has true meaning and impact for Indigenous people and all Canadians.
One of the things that I always tell my students most transparently is we can recognize the National Day for Truth and Reconciliation, but also still recognize how fundamentally, from a human rights level, there's so many nations and communities that don't even have clean drinking water. So when we look at this conversation about atrocities that happened in the past, we can also really center the fact that atrocities are happening in the present as well. And I think keeping that in mind is so vital when acknowledging the National Day for TRC.
And could a 1% hike in the HST become the solution when it comes to financing municipal infrastructure projects? Economist Greg Brett argues it could.
HST is 10%. So one percentage point is actually one-tenth of the province's HST revenue. That's $225 million-ish. You say, why HST? And not just say, well, why don't we go back to where we were, where the province had an unconditional grant program that was bigger. We've had 50 years of having a grant program, and then every year it just kind of gets whittled away. Why HST and not something else? Well, the real reason is to go back to Saskatchewan. They're working on the same thing, and so we have models.
Welcome to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
You are on the air with Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
So September 30th is the National Day for Truth and Reconciliation across the country, and it has been since 2021 when the Government of Canada passed a Bill C-5 to make that day a federal statutory day of remembrance. This to honor the children who never returned home and survivors of residential schools, as well as their families and communities. A professor at the University of Western Ontario is looking at whether the National Day for Truth and Reconciliation has true meaning and impact for Indigenous people. Cody Grote, who teaches in the Department of History and Indigenous Studies, asked if the day is just a surface-level acknowledgement from Canada, or if the day holds a true meaning towards reconciliation. Grote says he believes both can be true. He details how the work done with the National Day of Truth and Reconciliation can provide opportunities for survivors, families of survivors, and the public to remember the impacts of residential schools. Andrew Dow in Oshawakin, Ontario, spoke with Cody Grote about the National Day of Truth and Reconciliation, commemoration of Indigenous landmarks, and his personal history with the Mohawk Institute in Brantford.
I've been at Western for just about 3.5 years now, and I teach courses relating to Indigenous history in what is now Canada, Indigenous history predating Canada. I also teach courses on museums and public history as they relate to Indigenous peoples, so how First Nations, Inuit, and Métis communities are reclaiming our ancestral and cultural sites, or reclaiming our cultural artifacts. And then again, I also teach courses on residential schools, which is particularly important for both First Nations, Inuit, Métis, and non-Indigenous students as well.
And what inspired you to take on that path and led you to teaching at a university level on those topics?
I think, it's definitely been a breakaway from the rest of my family's trajectory. My father did not finish high school. He passed away in 2022, and he dropped out of school at about grade 10. He was a survivor of the 60 Scoop who was returned to his biological parents when he was about 10 years old. And my grandparents were survivors of the Indian residential school system as well, notably the Mohawk Institute. So it's definitely a big transition away from the experiences of some of my family members and some of my ancestors. But teaching in the university context, it's been so fulfilling to see, especially First Nations students from local communities who are coming, who are taking Indigenous studies, who are challenging what they've learned before. And it's also so important for me to learn from the students on a daily basis. And I really do think of it as a teaching experience for both students and me as a professor. So it's been great just to try to engage in those conversations.
And so speaking on your work and how it relates to the National Day of Truth and Reconciliation, how does the commemoration of Indigenous landmarks and historic sites work towards that?
I think one thing that's interesting about both the National Day for Truth and Reconciliation and about commemorating historic sites is that question of, is this surface level recognition? So for example, when the Canadian state recognizes a site as being a national historic site or nationally significant, does that actually come with anything, or is it just sort of a surface level of acknowledgement? And, you know, a lot of my research looking at how Canada has commemorated sites in the past, you really do see the Canadian state sort of massaging the interpretation of what they would like to present as being nationally significant or relevant to the story of Canada developing. And that's often ignored or minimalized or erased Indigenous history. But as well, when we look at the National Day for Truth and Reconciliation, when I teach that to my Canadian history students, my Indigenous history students, my residential school history students, we always ask, is this a day that is meaningful? Or is this a day that's a surface level acknowledgement? And I think I really do think it's both. I think that it's so vital. I know that for the first day ever that the National Day for TRC was celebrated, my father, who was just diagnosed with cancer at that time, it was so meaningful for him to see all of the orange shirts. And he went to the Mohawk Institute site where his parents attended, and he was very visibly moved. But then we also see a lot of acknowledgement from businesses, corporations, political figures who really do treat it as just a surface level day, a passing recognition. So, you know, National Day for TRC commemoration, they go hand in hand, those conversations about, is this something that's meaningful and who is the appropriate audience?
And speaking on how the day has evolved, I guess, what kind of sites would you like to see recognized that maybe don't get recognized by Canada during this time?
You know, I really do think of that question, and I will give a shout out to Heather George, who's the current executive director of the Woodland Cultural Center, who has been a friend of mine for many years. And we've had conversations about this in regards to some sites associated with Six Nations or with other Haudenosaunee communities. And one thing that, you know, she really challenged me to think about is how perhaps commemoration from the Canadian state is actually counter to ideas of Indigenous cultural or political sovereignty. And that's really an idea that I'm embracing more and more. Like, recognition by the Canadian state as something being nationally significant is perhaps something that's important for the Canadian state and the general Canadian population. But we can also recognize that federal recognition of significant sites might not be in line with intellectual or cultural sovereignty of Haudenosaunee citizens, of First Nations citizens across the country. So I think that really is a question to balance about, you know, moving forward, do we want to see more sites commemorated or recognized by the Canadian state, or do we want to challenge that idea of what commemoration means in that context?
And recently it was announced that Woodland Cultural Center is seeking to have the Mohawk Institute designated as a National Historic Site. Could you speak on that and what it would mean to have that designation be successful?
Sure. So the designation of National Historic Sites of Canada have been around since 1919. There's something called the Historic Sites and Monuments Board of Canada. It's an advisory board of historians, archaeologists, museum curators, one representative from every province and territory. And they consider proposals for recognizing either sites, people, or events as being nationally significant. And all of those recommendations for national significance are then approved by the federal government through the Minister of the Environment. And when we look at the Mohawk Institute as potential national historic site, we've seen recently a wave of other former residential schools being designated as national historic sites. But one thing that's really interesting is the justifications for why these sites are significant is often challenging perhaps the colonial interpretation of residential schools. So it's recognizing the assimilative aspects of the residential school. It's recognizing the systemic harm to families and communities. But it's also looking at a site like Woodland and saying the significance of this building is not just the residential school system, but the fact that since 1972, it's been a site of language revitalization and cultural continuity. So I think that's what's really interesting about a potential national historic designation for the Mohawk Institute, the ability not just to focus on cultural assimilation, but then also the ways that the Haudenosaunee and other First Nations have reclaimed the Mohawk Institute and the Woodland Cultural Center to revitalize our culture and assure cultural continuity. So I think it's really exciting to see this conversation happening, and I think that the team at the Woodland Cultural Center will really truly engage in consultation and collaboration with community to assure that the right interpretations are presented.
And do you know what kind of role that the community, the Indigenous community, would play in shaping the public's memory, I guess? Yeah. About the community's past with the site?
I think that's really open to the nominator. In this case, the nominator would likely be the Woodland Cultural Center. And I think that community involvement will be based on the approach that Woodland would find beneficial in regards to this process. At the end of the day, what's really tricky about a National Historic Designation is that the final decisions are made by the Historic Sites and Monuments Board of Canada, this federally appointed advisory body. That being said, in regards especially to residential school commemoration, they almost will always accept the recommendations that are made by descendant communities, so by Six Nations or by Watar, by whatever communities have a role in the Mohawk Institute as well. So I think what we'll see is we'll see a community involvement. I'm sure we'll have interpretive sessions or ask for advice from the community. It'll be dependent upon what the nominator Woodland finds is best for them, from my understanding.
And just talking about your personal history with the building and discovering that your grandparents attended it in the 1900s, can you walk us through that experience and what that was like finding that out?
Sure. So my grandfather, Stanley Grote, attended the Mohawk Institute in the 1910s. He was born in 1910 himself. He attended the Mohawk Institute for only a few years, and then he was amongst the children impacted by enfranchisement following the First World War. So he left the Mohawk Institute in 1919 upon his father and mother being enfranchised, and then he later engaged in the process of getting his status back. My grandmother, Jean Miracle, her story is a bit more complex and convoluted. She was born during the war as well, and she was not raised with her biological parents. She was raised with uncles and cousins. And from the best of our knowledge, she was potentially at Indian day schools in Six Nations for a small period of time before attending either the Mohawk Institute or Mount Elgin. And she was very... she was not comfortable disclosing any of her experiences, so we're sort of working through that archival paper trail with the National Center for Truth and Reconciliation. So, like many of our ancestors and family members, there was the reluctance to engage in storytelling, and both of those figures, my grandfather Stanley and my grandmother Jean, died in the 1980s before residential school discourse was really part of our public conversations, and before there was that more transparent openness to share experiences as students.
And did you or your family members ever feel any impact from finding out that, like, realization?
So my father was a survivor of a 60 scoop, and he was a really unique situation. He was removed from his biological parents, Stanley and Jean, who were residential school survivors, but then he was returned to them later on, and he had a very fractured relationship with his, but also still recognized how fundamentally, from a human rights level, there's so many nations and communities that don't even have clean drinking water. So we look at this conversation about atrocities that happened in the past, we can also really center the fact that atrocities are happening in the present as well. And I think keeping that in mind is so vital when acknowledging the National Day for TRC.
All right, Cody, thank you very much for doing this, and thank you for sharing your story with us as well.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Do you have questions or comments? Our email is radio@frequencynews.ca.
So we all know that municipalities from all across the country are looking for ways to finance their infrastructure programs without putting the burden on property owners only. They have been knocking on the doors of provincial and federal governments to ask them to lend them a helping hand. They have been heard from time to time, but a more permanent solution and stable solution could be at hand. Could a 1% hike in the harmonized sales tax become the solution when it comes to financing municipal infrastructure projects? New Brunswick's municipalities have been asking for changes to the system by which they fund themselves for years, and now a report by Mount Allison Economist is helping them make their case. In his report toward a new fiscal framework for New Brunswick municipalities, Dr. Brett outlines the financial issues facing local governments and recommends a diversified income for municipalities through an allocation of 1% of the provincial HST. Municipalities want something done, says Brett, in a chat with Erica Butler in Sackville, New Brunswick.
New Brunswick's municipalities have been asking for changes to the system by which they fund themselves for years, and now a report by a Mount Allison economist is helping them make their case. Economics professor Craig Brett has authored a report recommending a way for municipalities to diversify their income by allocating 1% of the provincial HST to go towards municipal budgets and infrastructure needs. Brett stopped by CHMA to explain his research and conclusions and started off describing the problem with municipal funding in New Brunswick.
The need for municipal financial reform is one of those things that is in response to things that happen slowly. You know, it's one of these things that's not a problem, not a problem, not a problem, still not a problem, still not a problem. And all of a sudden it is a problem, even though it's the same trends that are going on.
Brett says there are two big trends that have led the province and its municipalities to this point.
Big trend number one is that the share of money that municipalities get from the province by way of grants from the province has gone down considerably. In the report, I track from 2000 to 2022 or 2023, and municipalities used to get, you know, 16-17% of their money from the province back at the turn of the millennium, and now they get about 5 or 6 by way of unconditional grants. So that shortfall has to be made up somewhere. This didn't happen overnight. It was step by step, step by step. I mean, back in the 1980s, that the number that they got from the province was closer to 40. So this has been going on for you know, not 25 years. It's been going on for 50 years. This steady decline in the amount of money, at least in real terms, and certainly in terms of share of expenditures that municipalities are getting from the province, which means they have to turn to their other ways of raising money. And for municipalities, that's essentially the property tax.
The second big trend Brett identified in his report is the faster growth in value of residential property versus commercial or industrial property. It's something he didn't notice when studying the sector 15 years ago. But the trend, when combined with a provincial regulation that keeps residential and commercial tax rates in a fixed ratio, means residential taxes are filling the gap left by dwindling provincial grants to municipalities.
It meant that little by little, residences were taking a larger and larger share of the property tax bill. Add to that, of course, now the overall property tax bill has to go up to backfill the loss in grants from the province, and we see kind of a double whammy on the residential sector.
Brett says he found that the share of municipal funding coming from the residential sector grew from 49% in 2000 to 62% today. Meanwhile, the share borne by the non-residential sector has stayed roughly the same.
So it's not that the businesses are paying a lower share than they used to. They're paying about the same. But residences are paying a lot more, or at least a lot higher share, and they're basically backfilling what the province isn't doing anymore.
Brett's study also looked into the municipal infrastructure gap, essentially the growing backlog of maintenance and renewals for municipal infrastructure such as buildings, roads, and water systems. To estimate that, Brett looked at asset management plans for a number of New Brunswick cities and found that on an annual basis, there was a shortfall in funding for infrastructure equal to about 10% of municipal budgets, or about $120 million per year. He also identified a gap in the province's efforts at equalization among municipalities, which has been dwindling along with the decline in provincial grants. But Brett's report isn't just focused on the problems. The economist was charged with coming up with solutions, which brings us to one of his main recommendations, using one percentage point of the provincial HST to fund municipalities.
Now, to deal with both the infrastructure backlog and kind of an equalization program, which I haven't talked about much in this interview, would take on the order of $200 million. One percentage point of the province's HST revenue, that is one percentage point, by which I mean, you know, HST is 10%, so one percentage point is actually one-tenth of the province's HST revenue. That's $225 million-ish, according to the last fiscal year that was completed. So so the numbers match up. You say, why HST and not just say, well, why don't we go back to where we were, where the province had an unconditional grant program that was bigger? The reason you want to tie it to something is we've had 50 years of having a grant program, and then every year it just kind of gets whittled away. And so tying it to a particular revenue source kind of prevents that kind of day-to-day death by a million cuts, or whatever you want to call it, the kind of the other priorities coming up, and all of a sudden the municipal financing envelope is kind of the last one at the table, which is almost, you almost see that. I mean, that's sort of just slow decline of that that share of finance coming from the province. And so one way to kind of say, okay, if we do a reset on the grant, how do we keep that last 50 years from repeating themselves over the next 50 years? You tie it to something else. And so that's why tying the grant pool to something measurable and visible and is desirable. And why HST and not something else? Well, the real reason is in Quebec and Saskatchewan, they're working on the same thing. And so we have models.
Brett's recommendation includes using no more than half of the revenue from this 1% HST allocation to go towards municipal operating budgets, including a program of equalization. The other half or more would go towards the infrastructure backlog. He says part of the appeal of the 1% HST solution was that it's been tried elsewhere.
Municipalities want something done. You know, they kind of feel like the amalgamation was part of a broader process that would have included, okay, well, we now have places that we have to serve that we didn't serve before. How does all that fit in with the money part of things? Because it's going to take money. And they feel like the job of municipal restructuring is only half done. You know, the physical stuff is done, but the money part is just left to drift right now. And so whatever is recommended has to be something that looks like it's possible to implement soon.
Brett's report comes at the request of the Union of Municipalities of New Brunswick, and the timing is important. With a provincial election happening October 21st, Brett has been presenting his report with HST recommendation to all parties, and the UMNB has been vocal, even hosting a municipal forum with party leaders in Fredericton this week. While the timing of the report is intentional, says Brett, it's just a coincidence that Premier Higgs, around the same time that Brett was coming up with his recommendations, pitched the idea of cutting the HST by 2% if the PCs are reelected.
The Premier made that announcement the same day I came to that conclusion, like about 12 hours later, I'm like, oh, the HST thing, that makes some sense. And then 12 hours later, I hear that the premier made that announcement, and I'm like, oh my goodness. So I was quite, my first reaction was, oh dear. And then my second reaction was, oh, so maybe the province doesn't need one of those points for the HST after all. And then my third reaction was, probably the wise one, which is, yeah, I get it. This is all part of the overall provincial budgeting exercise. We're talking about slicing up the amount of money that the province takes in a particular way. And I suppose if we add the municipal sector as well, the Frasers is the one taxpayer, and we're trying to figure out the right way to carve up that responsibility for paying what governments do across different sectors of the economy. What the timing of this is about is to what the Union of Municipalities in New Brunswick want is to make sure that the political parties are at least thinking about this as they're coming up with their priorities for the election, and then beyond the election, whoever wins, how they're going to govern the province. There's no doubt about that. The timing isn't a coincidence. What happens to the HST revenue or anything else that the province takes is going to be determined by, what happens on October 21.
So. That's Mount Allison economist Craig Brett, whose recent report on municipal finances recommending the province allocate 1% of the HST to municipalities to help diversify their revenues away from residential property taxes, to provide some equalization, and to help close the infrastructure gap.
That's it for us at Viewpoints. Be sure to catch all our stories on frequencynews.ca. Our team just got a lot bigger, with some 30 journalists contributing to our website and radio programs. Thanks to both our journalists this week, Erica Butler and Andrew Dow, national editors Maureen McEwen and Victoria Fenner. Viewpoints is brought to you by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Local Journalism Initiative. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassaigne. Nice to have you with us this week, and until the next, ciao.
Radio@frequencynews.ca. Thank you.
Hello, welcome back to Plugged in My Ears. My name is Sam. I'm joined by my lovely co-hosts, Adam and Kyle. We have lots to talk about this week. I'm not quite sure where to begin, but I think we'll talk about Patrick Laine first because that's the first thing that comes to mind. Adam, this is a pretty significant blow for the Montreal Canadiens. I'm sure that this is really close and personal to you and you have a lot of thoughts. So maybe I'll let you begin on this this particular topic here.
Yeah, I'm the definition of a biased Habs fan when it comes to this situation because I was fuming when I saw this happen, okay? I think the Toronto Maple Leafs are a bunch of scumbags. I think that the hit was clearly intentional and dirty. I think Cedric Paré deserves to be suspended from the league. I mean, the fact that there was no penalty on the play is crazy. And I was reading an article in the Montreal Gazette, okay, so not biased. And they said that if you high stick someone and you get blood on it, it's a automatic double major, right?
Yeah.
Even if it's accidental. So where's the difference on this? Like, he clearly stuck his knee out. That isn't disputed. Like, you can see it when Laine goes between the two Leafs defenders, Perret's already beat, so he sticks out his knee.
Kind of disagree with that quite a bit.
Okay, well, sorry. Sam, let me have my moment because I'm fuming. This is big for me because I was huge on Laine. I was really expecting a big season from him. And I mean, I loved the trade when they got him. And now a stupid preseason game has wiped that away from Montreal. And I mean, Reinbacher got injured. I'm like, you know what? I'm ready. Done. Let's get rid of the preseason. We don't need it anymore. Just do training camp where you're playing against play the prospects. I mean, there's no reason that Laine should be out 4 to 5 months now because some dummy on the Leafs is trying to make the team because he's sick of playing in the AHL and making $2 an hour. I think it's ridiculous. I don't know. Sam, go ahead.
Okay. I mean, I understand the criticism and I understand why people think that hit was dirty and it looked dirty. And look, the guy stuck his hands out when he realized he was going to miss him with the hit. But I think a lot of people don't realize when you're skating forward to go and hit someone, it's natural for your legs to make a triangular shape. And as a result of that, your knees to be displaced outside of your body. That's how you maximize your power. Laine, and with all due respect, kind of tried to skate through two guys. It's not obvious to me that the Toronto Maple Leafs were trying to injure him under that play. It was mostly just a collision in that capacity. It was totally knee on knee. That was a knee on knee penalty. But my point is, that was not an intentional knee on knee. It's really difficult to argue that he stuck his knee out there. Anyone who's played knows that's a natural skating stride that he took to try and follow through with a hit. And accidentally, he bumped into Laine. That's all I'll say.
Look, I don't think he meant to hurt him.
Yeah, he didn't mean to hurt him. And I guarantee you he did not mean to stick his knee out. But he did. And that should have been a suspension for at least a game.
I'm bringing up the video.
You can bring up the video all you want, but there's a reason why the NHL isn't saying that this is malevolent and malicious.
What I will say is, you know what, the NHL protects top players, and I guess Patrick Laine maybe isn't really fully there right now, but if that, something like that happened to McDavid, actually,
or Matthews,
they would have been.
It has happened, right? So it has happened to McDavid before, and people have gotten in huge trouble for doing it. It's usually more dramatic when it happens to McDavid because he's such a fast skater. So it just obvious.
And it looks worse too because he's so fast.
I mean, I honestly, after seeing this clip right here, I saw the stop motion of the knee on knee hit. And you can see, he's trying to cut him off there.
But then look at him stick out the knee.
That's a natural stride. I'm sorry.
He tried to block his route, he tried to block his path.
That's not knee on knee. Knee on knee is very different. It's when you stick your knee outside of the range of which you would usually stick your leg out when you're skating.
That looks like he did that. I think what happened is this. He tried to play the body, so he stuck his body out, but he forgot what his legs were doing, and his leg adjusted to brace himself, so he tried to block him with his body, and then his knee went out to do that, and then he got the bottom half there.
Yeah, that's a stride, Adam. I'm really sorry. That's how I skate, too.
But he wasn't skating, though.
He was stopped.
When you go to take a stride, you have to push out like that. You drive forward with your legs.
I'm not saying
you don't
he drove
back.
Forward, but I'm saying he was playing the body.
Yeah.
Body. He wasn't thinking about his legs.
He drove out and then tried
to block and his legs.
He wasn't. But my point, if he was trying to only hit him knee on knee, his hands wouldn't have been up there in the first place either.
All right. Well,
if you can't play,
you shouldn't be playing.
It's a dirty play. Yeah. We'll put it that way.
It's a dirty play. You should have got at least a penalty, at least a minor penalty.
No, that should have been a 5-minute major minimum. A knee on knee, even if it's accidental, in minor league hockey, is a 10-minute misconduct. You're done for the game. It's ridiculous that that wasn't at least a 5-minute penalty in the NHL.
In all honesty, they don't happen that easily. Like, so it's kind of like, no. You know what? If one happens, like, it's pretty easy to call a penalty. So yeah, it's pretty weird.
I'm pretty surprised. But in any case, what does this mean for Montreal now? Because Laine may not keep playing, but Montreal will keep playing. So what does this look like for them?
Season's done, man. No, I'm just kidding. But I want to talk about something that happened after the hit, too. So Arbor Jacki took exception to this
hit
and beat the living crap out of Cedric Perre. And Perre was like, in his post-game interview, was like, oh, yeah, you just jumped me. I wasn't expecting it. Sam, is that a reasonable thing for a hockey player to injure the star player of the other team and then expect no retaliation from the other team?
I think it's not. But you have to take into consideration that Perron didn't think that he was doing anything wrong because he didn't intend to do it. So that's why in his head he wasn't expecting that. But I understand why he was jumped on. Although I think there's a classier way to go about a fight.
I don't know. I go back to the Toronto Maple Leafs Montreal Canadiens playoff series, where John Tavares, his head was hit by Corey Perry's knee.
Yeah.
Okay, the very next play, Corey Perry someone dropped the gloves with Corey Perry. Yeah. Corey Perry stood his ground and fought. Okay?
Yeah. But Corey Perry also saw that coming.
I mean, but it wasn't a dirty hit. Perry didn't do anything to Tavares. Tavares was on the ice and Perry was just skating. And they had to cart Tavares off. They had to pretty much carry Laine off. So, I mean, I don't really understand how Perry can just be like, oh, yeah, I wasn't ready for it. Like, I didn't expect this to happen. Like, I feel like that's dumb on his part.
The only reason why he didn't expect it to happen is because the guy came from behind. If he'd been facing him, I promise you he would have fought. There's a big difference. There's a dynamic you don't take into consideration here. Corey Perry, like, whether his hit was clean or dirty, it is irrelevant. But he knew that by virtue of hurting Tavares, because at that point he knew he hurt Tavares. Mm-hmm. I don't know if Perron knew that he hurt Laine at that point. I don't know.
He got stretchered off.
He got stretchered off, but the fight happened before he got stretchered off. The fight happened before Perron turned back around to look at Laine.
No. It happened after they resumed play, like Perry's next shift.
Yeah. It was like a
later. No, but that's my point, because at that point, Perry already knew that he hurt Tavares, so he was expecting something to happen. Perron did not know that he hurt Laine.
They're both named Perry. It's Corey Perry and Cedric Perry.
Perry? Is it not Perron?
No, Perry. Oh, so, what I mean is, so Perry hit Laine.
Yes.
Laine gets off the ice. The next time Perret's on the ice, Jacki starts grabbing at his jersey, trying to get him to fight, and he pretty much just curls up in a ball, and Jacki's like, okay, I'm still going to beat the crap out of you.
Still in that case, though, like, if the guy... The difference is Corey Perry was facing the player who came to fight him, right?
Yeah, Perry acknowledged that, like, okay, this Leafs guy is going to avenge his player. Like, got to drop the gloves and fight.
But you're still missing something. The Leafs player did not skate from behind and start attacking the back of his head. I don't think anyone in the world can prepare to get punched in the back of the head.
That's what I'm saying. Jacki was grabbing the jersey to initiate the fight. It's not like he just started hammering at him. He was grabbing the jersey. Then, and then when Perry didn't respond, he just lit him up
from the back of the head.
Yeah. I understand the fine.
Perry should have fought the first time he got the chance, but if a player says no, the next alternative option is just to light him up again.
I don't know. I think if you injure someone, you should know that something's coming for you.
You should know something's coming for you. But if you choose not to fight, you should expect to get run from behind, not punched in the back of the head.
Well, clearly we know this Perry guy's pretty dumb anyway, so.
I don't know. I mean, I think the problem with the preseason is you got someone like this who's kind of just a random player who comes out and just causes an injury and with almost no retribution, right? So it's just like, okay, he's going to go back down to...
Well, I agree. He should have fought. He should have fought, but he didn't. But that's the code of conduct in hockey, the unspoken rule is that if a guy refuses to fight, then you light him up when he does something like that.
Oh, yeah.
That's what it is. If someone did something like that to a star player on my team, I tried to fight them, they said no, I just wait till I get the puck and I'd run them from behind head first into the boards.
I mean, I think tensions are high. I mean, yeah, like injuries like that are silly. And another one where we have to talk about is, Drew Doughty got injured too. Right. Broken ankle. He needs surgery.
Oh, he does need surgery, eh?
Yeah. Have you seen the clip of that one? Pretty silly injury too. It's just like, okay.
I don't know why they're playing good players in this.
Yeah. In this Drew Doughty playing is a bit random. I don't know.
I thought he was a lock on that team.
Yeah. I mean, usually they don't start star players, but you know, some people just want to get a warm up and get back into the rhythm of things. But yeah, no, it's been a bad start for preseason for sure.
Yeah. Going back to what you asked, Sam, about what Montreal's outlook is for the rest of the season now. Well, I mean, I think the expectations just go down a little bit. I think the expectations are still that they are better than last year, and they add a few points, but I do think that it's not looking fantastic for them to do that this year. minus line A, and we don't know how long Rheinbacher is going to be out either, but just disappointing to see I was so high on line A. And
but don't they have a pretty reasonable good like way of estimating that line A will be back in 4 months or so? Wasn't that what they were saying?
They say like best case is like best case is he's week to week, and then like
but oh they still
second
oh.
best case would be like 4 months, and then worst case is season ending, so
slash career ending.
But who knows? Yeah.
Anyways, I mean, on the positives, you potentially have a lot of cap space opening up. So, maybe they'll do something with that, but yeah, we'll see.
Yeah, some cap space would be nice, but I mean, I don't know. I don't know. It's just disheartening to watch.
It is disheartening.
I would have even rather it happen in the first regular season game, because at least we would have got to see Line play a meaningful game, but...
Yeah.
So, I don't know. Stupid.
Yeah, although I will say, though, I just watched Drew Doughty's injury. That was a little bit different. Drew Doughty's foot just looked like it got caught up in the boards a little
bit. No, I'm saying it was just a fluke. Yeah, it was weird, but anyways, like, yeah, weird stuff happens, and it sucks to have that happen in a preseason game for sure.
Yeah, it does. But how do you guys feel about this global series? So there's games in Prague. Well, first of all, let's talk about Prague specifically. It's New Jersey is playing in Prague against... where are they playing again? Well, anyways, New Jersey's playing there, but... Sounds like it's got some pretty high attendance already. Tickets sold out pretty quickly for that one.
Yeah.
I know we talked about the Global Series last year, because last year was where Australia, I think, if that's not wrong.
Mm-hmm.
In any case, though, do you guys think the Global Series in general is good for the game? Or
I think it's not bad. I mean, I think it's definitely a step in the right direction. I mean, Europe is kind of an interesting market because they've got their own hockey.
Mm-hmm.
And the NHL hasn't really tapped into it fully. I would like to see them pushing hockey in some other places, honestly.
Like where in particular?
Just go think a bit outside the box. Like go to, like, I don't even know, something South America or something. Just like
Brazil? No.
Just really, yeah, I don't know. Just like really try to open up things. Like, but no, I think Prague's a good choice. You got definitely a decent amount of hockey fans over there.
Oh yeah, so sorry, it's Buffalo, New Jersey, and Prague.
Yeah, that's right. Buffalo's played in Germany like yesterday against
Red Bull Munich. Yeah.
And then they play New Jersey in Czechia. Yeah. And then Finland is Dallas
and Florida. Florida. Yeah.
Interesting. What do you think the outcome would be? Do you think the NHL teams are gonna mop the floor with some of those teams or
Well, they're playing each other. New Jersey's playing Buffalo and Dallas is playing Florida.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure Buffalo beat.
Yeah, 5-0. They beat the Red Bull team. Yeah.
I mean, yeah. I think one thing's interesting, and people don't really realize this. Most of the guys who play in like the DEL, the German Elite Hockey League, same with the Swedish Elite Hockey League and all that, they're pretty close to NHL caliber.
Oh, no.
Like I don't know if it's fair to say that they're the same as AHL caliber or better or worse.
I think they are better.
I think they're the players that are exactly in between AHL and NHL. That's what it is to me.
I think you've got the NHL and then you got the KHL, which is like a very close second. And then I honestly would say the Dell is probably the third most competitive.
You think it's better than the Swedish?
I think it's better than the Swedish Hockey League now.
Why is that?
Just because I feel like it seems to be a place where a lot of former NHL players go.
Yeah,
and it is, I mean, like the game, it seems competitive too. I don't know if it's maybe their lack of. So I know like Sweden has a lot of different divisions. Like they have like their top division. Three, four, yeah, right? One, two. Yeah. But I feel like the Dell only has like two or three or.
Yeah, Dell one. So Dell, which is the number one. Yeah. Dell two.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it's actually called Dell three.
Okay.
I think it's called something else, but it's really just Dell one, Dell two.
Yeah. I don't know. I think it's really competitive from what I've seen. And I mean, like obviously like Leon Draisaitl played there. Mm-hmm. I mean the German, like Tim Stützle, like Germany is on the rise for sending hockey players. I mean, JJ Paterka on the Sabres, like I remember when I was like first watching hockey, like the only German player I knew was like Marcel Gauch. And like now it's like one of the second best player in the league or highest paid NHL player in the world is German, so
yeah,
I think it's definitely on the rise. And I mean,
Think about it. Actually, we had a former Dell player come on our podcast last year.
We did,
plugged in my ears. John Tripp played in the Dell for a long time and had his jersey retired over there.
Yeah,
so it is growing. I think one of the advantages they have over the Swedish league, though, is that the Dell can have more imports from overseas.
Because
usually those leagues, you have to have a certain amount of players that are from your country, and it used to be 80% in the Dell, and now it's 60.
Oh, okay.
So 4/10 of your team can.
Be
Canadian, which is, I mean, kind of what they end up being. They end up being Canadian, right?
So yeah, Yeah. So, and then, yeah, then I think the AHL, I don't know if the AHL used to be more competitive, but it just doesn't seem to be like I can't
remember. It just seems like people don't want to play there. That's the thing.
Yeah. I don't know if it's like the cities that they're in or like.
I can't imagine. Can you imagine playing in Belleville? Not that it's bad, but like you could be playing in Belleville, like you could be playing in LA.
Well, I remember very clearly what John said about when he was in the A, is that he was moving so much. Like, he literally was not in one place for more than like a week or something. Mm. He was getting transferred between AHL teams
and the East Coast.
He's getting, put up and down. Some people are even bouncing between the AHL and other feeder teams below that. Yeah. So like you're just completely all over the place. And if you're an older player, you have a family or something, it's like, yeah, I don't think I would want to be doing that anyways, right?
Yeah, you go over to Germany and you're playing, at least you're playing in the same place for the most part. Like
the same country.
The same country, yeah.
And not only that, you're playing in some really nice places. Like, can you imagine playing in, like, I don't know, well, Munich, Frankfurt, Dresden? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Those are some nice places.
Well, another thing about the NHL is it's kind of, you don't really have that many shots. So once you've messed up a shot, your shot, you don't get that many chances.
Off, yeah.
And you kind of just stay in the AHL, and it's tough.
Also, I don't know if it's me, but I feel like players that if you play more than almost like 2 or 3 years in the AHL, your like chances of making the NHL are going down significantly. Well, and you're over in Europe playing like even like I've seen players like play 6 years in the KHL and then come over to the like Artemi Panarin came over at like 24 or something like that, and like light up the NHL. I don't know, I just feel like I can't think of an AHL player that lit up the AHL, came to the NHL and was solid, and like I remember them now. Like I don't know, I just feel like it's less of a feeder and more of just like a
I think
holding,
the AHL is
yeah,
great.
Cell.
I think the AHL is great if you're a first round draft pick who just does not make it for a year. Like think of on a Los Angeles. Not Brent Clark. Brent Clark is going to be that guy next year because I think he's going to play a bit more.
But I mean, but
Byfield. Yeah. Quinton Byfield played 2 years in the AHL. First year was okay. Second year, he lit it up. And now he's pretty freaking good on LA.
Yeah, I see Kyle over here searching up Shane Wright, too, because, I mean, like, he's cooking in the AHL. Yeah. And I mean, like he had a great season with Coachella Valley. So, I mean...
Do you think he's got a chance at making the Seattle team?
I think so. I think this year, definitely. Yeah.
Yeah, he had decent. He had 47 points in 59 games.
But like even then, I would kind of expect more out of someone that was so like highly drafted too.
I kind of wonder what ended up happening. Like
He was in a really weird year. So he got drafted from that COVID bubble kind of year.
As an underager in the first overall.
Yeah, but he had almost no development. Like he didn't play real games. Like people in that
But COVID do you remember year, how good he was in his first year as an underager in the OHL?
Yeah. But I'm saying he got drafted based on what he did like 3 years prior.
NHL, you mean?
Yeah, almost. Because the years like just leading up to the NHL were COVID years where he just played the same teams over and over again in a bubble.
Well, kind of. There was one year when we were like the year before where COVID hit in March, he was the best rookie in the NHL by far. Second best was Mason McTavish, who turned out to be great. Then Shane Wright, when he came back from COVID, did not do very good in the OHL, and that's why he fell down the rankings.
Yeah.
But you're right, he did get drafted based off everything that happened before the pandemic, but he was good before the pandemic.
No, anyway, so he just didn't have enough time to mature. That was always my thing. He's still not old. He's not old.
He's young. Yeah. But I don't know. I think in that circumstance, the AHL is good, but it's just not as competitive as the majority of European hockey now.
But unfortunately for Shane Wright, I haven't heard a thing about him. So
maybe that's good though. Maybe that's good for him.
Maybe he just needed the spotlight off him for a little bit. I mean, I imagine the pressure's pretty high. Well, in fairness, I haven't heard that much about Bedard in a while either. Although I'm sure we will hear about him pretty soon.
Who's Bedard?
Who's that guy?
How many points do you think he's gonna get this year, Sam?
110.
I mean, Sidney Crosby at 120 on a decent Pittsburgh Penguins team. Okay. The issue with Bedard is he doesn't really have that many guys to work with.
Bro. Nick Foligno?
Mm-hmm. Okay, Nick Foligno's a beauty. Good Taylor hockey Hall?
I saw.
Yeah, but I'm saying even if he has those two guys, pretty good guys, the rest of the team itself is not great. It's more of a morale thing. Like, if he lets the losing get to him, then it's going to be difficult for him to put up points.
I'll give a better metric. What do you guys think? Over or under 80?
Over.
Over.
Over 80, really?
Yeah.
Whoa.
Well, what did he have this past season with injuries? Had 60 points essentially.
No, I think less than that, like 50, maybe 60 at most. But
High 50s.
So, well, I saw a good reference. So, he I think he had about 10-15% less points than McDavid did in his first year.
Per game?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's 61 points.
61 points.
Just under a point per game.
He so, played
68.
Anyways, but I mean, the, you know, the purpose is that he could, you know, he, I'd say 80, over 80 is a pretty fair assumption. Like, I'd say a point a game.
Mm-hmm.
Point a game was
I, like, I could see him hitting a point, like 1.12.
Yeah, I don't think I actually see him hitting 110. I think I,
but you
I,
could get pretty close to 100,
no,
though.
No, just because Chicago's so bad. Like,
that's my thing. Yeah. It's just because the team's bad.
I think 82 points.
Yeah.
82 points in 82 games.
Yeah.
Point per game player.
I'm putting him at like a 1.12, 1.2 points per game max.
Mm. Max, yeah.
Max, yeah.
If he stays,
like he could hit 96 points.
Yeah. So an interesting stat line is that, so he had, there's kind of two distinct like periods in his stats from last year, is the pre-injury and post-injury.
Okay.
So like when he's out for a bit with his jaw.
Yeah.
And he actually had significantly better point per game after. So like the latter half of the season, which I usually think is a really important metric because people kind of forget about that. Like Tage Thompson, for example, I remember he had that fantastic season, you know, 2 years ago, and everyone was like, so had such high hopes for him this past season. And I was like, you know, he's not going to be that good this year, I'm telling you. And it's because you base all the metrics off points per game and like trend lines, right? Tage Thompson started that season off on fire and kind of rode that to the tail end of the season and ended with a lot of points. But if you looked at the metric, it was like a total downwards trend, and he had way less points than the second half of the season. And what happened last year? Yeah, he had a pretty mediocre year, right? So,
yeah.
I mean, I think those trend lines are really important. And if yeah, Bedard is going upwards, I easily see him getting over 80 points as well. Yeah.
Yeah, certainly. Maybe in the interest of time, we'll shift to football because I think there's something worth mentioning because this has been a rough weekend for Adam with sports. But Buffalo did not do so good against Baltimore.
No, they got blown out last night by the Ravens, and I mean the Ravens were 1-2 going in. They had lost to the Raiders, who don't even get me started. Huh. They suck. So I mean, I thought the Bills were going to roll over them. Bills went in at 3-0. They dismantled the Cardinals in Week 1, crushed the Dolphins in Week 2, crushed the Jaguars in Week 3, and then they get crushed by the Ravens. And it was just the Bills did not look like the same Bills that I watched in Week 1-3. Josh Allen couldn't find his receivers. He didn't play a bad game, no interceptions again, but the Ravens' defense just looked incredible. So, I don't know. I think the Bills will bounce back, but you can't put up 10 points against these good teams if you expect to compete for a Super Bowl. So, disappointing, but I don't know. I'm not sweating it too much.
Yeah, well, what do you think the biggest issue was for Buffalo, though? Was it just a lack of coordination?
I think it was...
variety things?
I think it was a lot of silly mistakes. So there was a couple times at the end of the game, or not at the end of the game, in the third quarter when the Bills like scored a big, big play. Well, it was a big 50-yard reception by Shakir to get them down to like the 10, and then they punched it in for a rushing touchdown. But then the next time they get down in the red zone, they try this flea flicker play, and it gets them all confused, and they end up fumbling, and the Ravens pick it up and take it all the way back down to the Bills zone. So, I mean, like, just silly stuff like that. Like, the play calling was questionable. The Josh Allen's play was mediocre at best, but I mean, the receivers also just did not seem to get open, which had not really been an issue in Week 1-3. Obviously, the Ravens, I think, were the best team that they have played yet, and maybe they just weren't prepared for a team of that caliber, but things are going to have to change because they've got one of the toughest schedules in football. They've got the Chiefs coming up in a couple weeks. They've got the 49ers in a couple weeks. They've got the Rams, who look pretty good early on. It's not going to be an easy closeout to this season. And if the Bills, I mean, obviously starting 3-0 is very promising for them to make the playoffs, but they've got a tough schedule ahead of them. So, I mean, I think the only benefit is that the other teams in the AFC seem to be sucking pretty bad. The Jets lost yesterday to the Broncos, who Broncos are kind of consensuously known as like the worst team in the NFL right now. So Aaron Rodgers was kind of doing nothing over there. And then the Dolphins, their quarterback Tua Tagovailoa went down with a concussion in Week 2 against the Bills, and now they don't have a quarterback, and the Patriots are just the Patriots. They are very, very bad right now. So I don't know. I think that we're just, the Bills are hopefully going to be able to win a weak division, but who knows? I mean, if you lose games like that, you're not gonna win the division if you keep on losing like that. So I don't know.
No, very much so.
Yeah.
And then on the topic of football still, the Queens football team's not doing so great. I know you follow them a little bit better than I.
Yeah, yeah, no, they got.
But what do you think about that?
Yeah, they got they got smushed by Western, but I mean, seems to be the pattern in my 4 years of being at Queens is that they never beat Western. So I don't know if this is like maybe we're our year's a bad luck charm or something, but
we're the bad homies.
And also the games aren't even close. Like they aren't even losing by like two touchdowns or a touchdown. It was like 39-14. Like this is not even close football. I don't know what's happening there, but like. Just sucks as a student to have to know that your team really has no chance going into a game against the best team in the OUA. I don't know.
Western's the best team in OUA? Oh,
yeah. I would say so, yeah. They lost to Laurier this year, so maybe the top two teams, but Queens plays Laurier in a couple weeks. I don't think Queens has a chance. I mean, like, if they play like they did against Western, they won't win very many football games.
So does Queens have any chance of making it to the Vanier Cup, which they're hosting again this year?
I think it's very, very unlikely that they make it to the Vanier Cup. I think they'll make the, I don't know if they'll make the Yates Cup. So, I mean, we'll see. We'll see how it goes, but I don't know. Not too impressed with the way that they played this past weekend. They did have some injuries. I heard that their quarterback, Alex Freakin, got hurt. But, I mean, at the same time, next man up mentality's got to be there, right? So, I don't know.
Also, I don't know if you guys agree with this, but at least for my parents who went here years ago, it seemed like Queens was a really big football school. And, well, actually, maybe we should mention this now. CFRC, the name of this radio station, actually is Canada's finest rugby champions. After the First World War, Queens sort of changed quite a bit. A lot of the veterans who came back, who were students here before, who left school and then returned, started playing football. And Queens was the finest football team around. At the time, The name football didn't really exist. It was called rugby, but it was the same game as football is today. There's a separate rugby. That's where the name league rugby comes from, which is what actual rugby is presently. But when this radio station was created, it was created to broadcast the games in the Grey Cup, which Queens was playing in, because at the time it was university teams that were playing in the Grey Cup, not just, you know, the CFL. And so, essentially, Queens' identity was a football identity for a long time. It was a military identity, a football identity. The military identity sort of faded away over the years, but leading all the way up, even until the 90s, Queens was really a football school. My parents, when they went here in the 90s, were huge football fans. They went to every single Queens game. And I don't know, for better or for worse, most of the Queens football games I've been to have had a relatively low attendance. I'm not exactly sure what that means, but what do you think, Kyle? I mean, it's a unique change and departure from past traditions.
You know what? A lot of U sports, I feel like we follow a kind of interesting pattern. So I'll give you an example. Queens women's squash is the best in Canada by far. Not even close. It's actually rivals some D1 programs in the States for women's squash. But every other squash program in Canada is bad.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because a lot of U sports function in a sense of kind of like women's rugby here as well, where if you start a good enough foundation for a program, it kind of just continually builds on itself and the teams don't really vary. Like Queens women's rugby is going to be good for a super long time unless something huge happens. Just like squash probably isn't going to change here.
Yeah.
So if you know, and those things do change, but it's really hard to reset the timeline on that once you've built a good program, because the players are just going to kind of suction towards that good program, leaving the other ones kind of behind. And so to stay the top program's tough. And I think it's just mostly funding. Like if you just pour tons of funding into a program and you really work on getting all the best athletes, that'll continue legacy. But other than that, yeah, it's pretty hard to just continually maintain a top program.
Certainly. And I think that was well said. And maybe those will be the final words of this episode. But thank you all so much for joining us. We'll be back next Tuesday at 5:30 for another episode.
On October 1st and 2nd, you can meet over 115 employers in the main gym of the Athletics and Recreation Center. If you are considering a career in engineering, computing, or technology fields, then join us on October 1st for the Engineering and Technology Fair. On October 2nd, many top companies, organizations, and schools will be at the Career and Further Education Fair. While you're there, visit the Career and Resume Advising Cafe and the free LinkedIn photo booth. Both events are open to all Queen's students of all years and run from 10:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m.
It's been said that football is a game of inches. Even the smallest margin can mean the difference between victory and defeat. Elation and agony. The next round, or your final game. In 2023, the Gaels were on the wrong side of that margin as they lost their home opener in dramatic, heartbreaking fashion to the Laurier Golden Hawks. Now the Gaels find themselves in the role of the Road Warriors, traveling to Laurier's home turf, hungry for revenge. Who will prevail in this clash of Vanier Cup contenders? On Saturday, tune in to CFRC 101.9 FM or CFRC.ca to catch all the pulse-pounding action. The CFRC pregame show will begin at 12:45 p.m. with a 1 p.m. scheduled kickoff time. We hope you'll join us for this classic clash between two powerhouse